People State Colorado versus Daniel Evo Hare. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Thank you. Argument is set for half hour. I think you both were here, and most of the audience was last time, so I won't repeat myself. We're ready to start.
May it please the court, I'm Christine Brady, registration number 24779, representing the people, the petition in this case. Mr. Roldan's argument, and actually the arguments in all of his briefs, the arguments that you'll be hearing today, but based on the view that there's a substantial right to use a peremptory challenge in a non-curative way. And I know there's already been some discussion of that this morning, so this might be a little bit of deja vu, but I think I have an answer to the court's questions on that issue. If there's no substantial right, then there's only the protected right of the Sixth Amendment right to an impartial jury. So challenges to cause and peremptory challenges are just tools to achieve an impartial jury. They're just a means to an end, and there's no substantial right in themselves. So if that is true, then why did McCrander find that there's an absolute right to use all peremptory challenges in a non-curative manner? And the answer to that is it was choosing to rely on long-standing case law decisions that go back before the harmless error rule was passed in 1961. And in fact, even before there was a right to a criminal appeal. So I want to take a look at McCrander. McCrander was decided after Ross, and it rejected Ross, and it reaffirmed the 1911 view, which was the Kennedy case, cited in the briefs, of an absolute right to use all peremptory challenges in a non-curative fashion. It said, distinguished Ross, it said, well, okay, there's no constitutional right, but there's a substantial right to use it in that manner. It didn't really discuss that the harmless error rule was adopted in 1961. I don't think that was even a consideration. When we're talking about substantial rights, that term, the first place that it appears in Colorado law is in 1907, and there was a statute that was passed, and it was a harmless error rule, but it applied only to variances in charging documents. And the language of it is very important. It said that the error must prejudice the substantial rights of defendant on merits. Now, that term, substantial rights, the defendant on the merits, by its very nature, applies to the outcome of the proceeding. And we now know, under the United States v. Olano, that substantive rights do, that term does mean that it has affected the outcome of the proceeding. Another way of putting it is the reliability of the conviction. So McCrander, without placing this substantial right in the category of structural error, was able to require automatic reversal. Now, in Lefebvre, skipping to 2000, Lefebvre rejected Martinez Salazar and reaffirmed this absolute right. And what did it cite as the main reason? It cited to the long history of applying the right. And again, that long history goes back before the harmless error rule. The only way we could protect that outcome of a fair and impartial jury was to require automatic reversal.
Counsel, could I stop you just right there for a second? You suggested that in Lefebvre that we rejected Martinez Salazar, and I'm curious about that statement because, in my view, in our reading of Lefebvre, we actually simply distinguished it and said Martinez Salazar has no application to this type of arrangement where the prosecution was granted an extra peremptory.
That's correct.
Okay.
Thank you. So I look at that long-standing history, and we know that that's what Lefebvre was relying on. Lefebvre didn't have the benefit of Rivera v. Illinois. That didn't come along until 2009. And what Rivera says is there's no due process right to shape the jury separate and apart from the Sixth Amendment right to ensure an impartial jury. What Rivera said is you must show that a biased juror sat in order to obtain reversal. And it also said that errors of state law don't become federal due process violations. Another important thing that it did is it disavowed Swain v. Alabama. That was a 1965 case that was also applying, well, it was also based on those pre-harmless error cases. So since Rivera says there's no protected right to, basically what it says is there's no protected right to shape the composition of the jury, peremptory challenges are just auxiliary to that particular right that we're trying to protect. In other words, the defendant cannot appeal on the basis that one of his peremptory challenges that were exercised on a hunch, he can't appeal on that basis. He has to show that he challenged that juror for cause, and the whole reason why we do that is why we must show that a biased juror sat is because then the prosecution may be able to show that it's harmless beyond reasonable doubt. It would only be in rare circumstances that the prosecution would be able to show that. So if the defendant can show their biased juror sat, they would be able to obtain reversal. I also wanted to address a corollary issue is what was raised this morning. Is the issue of this net balance or parity of peremptory challenges. There's really no reason to have a net balance of peremptory challenges. If the biased juror didn't sit, that's the only law that that's the only rule we care about. We have never analyzed this net balance of peremptory challenges. To start out with, the peremptory challenges are tilted in the defendant's favor because the prosecution cannot appeal an erroneous denial of its challenge for cause. And then the last point that I wanted to make is there's really no cost to the defendant if the peremptory challenges are unequal. And it is appropriate to put the burden on the defendant because to cure the trial court challenges for cause, because the defendant is in the best position to cure. He has the information and he has obviously the best option to cure.
Why is that?
Well, he has the information. He knows which jurors that he thinks are biased against him. So we do put the burden on him to exercise a challenge for cause.
Could I ask you a question about the statute or rule dealing with peremptories again? Whatever the purpose of that was, and whatever it derives from, there is a right granted by statute to exercise a certain number of peremptories. And so
that's
correct. It seems to me, despite our discussion of harmless error and structural error and that kind of thing, we're sort of faced with the question that seems to me to be a primary difference between the way we had reasoned this before and McCrander and Martinez Salazar, the way the U.S. Supreme Court did, in that, and as Ms. Jones said, they seem to find this was just not error at all. Is that not the crux of our problem in terms of whether McCrander is still going to be the law?
No.
Is it error? And if so, what's the effect of that? Is there some way of measuring whether it's prejudicial or?
When you say it wasn't error, what exactly do you mean?
Well, I think what I had in mind was, I thought their rationale was, as long as the defendant, the defense, gets to exercise
the five peremptory
the number challenges. Of peremptories he is allowed by rule or statute, then that rule or statute has not been violated. Whereas we seem to have taken the position that if he has to expend one of those to cure an error by the judge with regard to a challenge for cause, then in effect he has been deprived of his statutory right.
Right, he hasn't been deprived of it because again, it's just a means to an end. The fact that we require exhaustion means that we are requiring it in a curative fashion to an extent. However, the defendant can still get relief if he's making his hard choice and he shows that he had to, you know, choose between two and he had to leave a biased juror on the jury, then he can obtain reversal.
Well, and just one follow-up. So is the thrust of that in your early argument about the purpose for this that if the defendant exercises all of the challenges he's entitled to,
then he has received all the due process that he's doing?
Because of the purpose, it doesn't make any difference whether it was curative or not. Is that the tie-in between...
That's correct. I'm going to reserve the rest of my time for the rebuttal.
You may.
May it please the court. My name is Steve Harlan, registration number 39020, representing Mr. Daniel Roland. I'd like to begin my argument discussing this issue the Attorney General raised concerning the source of the claims using the term substantial right. And in doing that, I'd like to point to footnote 12 in the Crandor, because I think that footnote is illustrative on that issue, as well as other issues before this court. In footnote 12 in the Crandor, this court stated, in contrast to Ross, the U.S. Supreme Court opinion, the issue in the instant case is not whether the jury selects to try the case is impartial in the constitutional sense of that term, but whether the trial court's erroneous ruling on a challenge for cause constituted harmless error or instead affected a substantial right of the defendant. And then the court went on to cite Colorado Appellate Rule 35E. Colorado Appellate Rule 35E basically states that an appellate court should disregard an error that does not affect a substantial right of a defendant or a party. That mirrors the language in Colorado Rule of Criminal Procedure 52A, which discusses that an error is harmless, it does not affect a substantial right of the defendant. So I think that clarifies that this court, when it issued McCrander, was clearly relying on Colorado law. It was not pinning its analysis in the least upon federal constitutional law. More, it was, in that case, this court clarified that it was relying on a harmless error rule as set forth under the Colorado rules.
Counsel, if I could pick up right there. I think that we've said in a number of places, and first of all, let me make sure that you agree that the right to peremptory challenges is not a constitutional right, it's simply a statutory right. Do you agree with that?
I agree that it's not under the Sixth Amendment.
Okay. In general, we've said over and over that for non-constitutional trial errors, we examine those under harmless error standard, and that harmless error standard requires us to examine whether it affected the outcome of the proceedings. That's how we assess the prejudice. Maybe you can take a different stab at it or another stab at explaining why this particular non-constitutional statutory right is so sacrosanct that it requires automatic reversal. I can't think of another example of such a right that we treat the same way.
Well, Your Honor, I think it is sacrosanct, and I'll get to that in a minute, but my initial response to your question is that the analysis that was explained in Crandor is based not only on the value of the peremptory challenge, but also on the reality of assessing the harm of the peremptory challenge. And that goes back to what this court discussed in Kennedy, that it is simply impossible to evaluate how the trial, and it turned out that the composition of the jury had been different. In the Crandor, this court acknowledged that reading and in fact explained it as unassailable. And I think this court recognized that in order to preserve the peremptory challenge, as has been established by the legislature, the sort of harmless analysis, error analysis that's set forth in the Crandor is necessary. Otherwise, there's simply no way to enforce the right. I do think also that this court has recognized in the Crandor, and in several other cases, Harris, Blades v. Defoe, Hilby LeKeever, that the peremptory challenge is an invaluable tool in terms of shaping the composition of the jury and ensuring a fair trial and impartial jury as is conceived of by our legislature. The peremptory challenge recognizes the realities of jury selection that defense attorneys will not necessarily, or any attorney from either side, necessarily have time to bet on the record bias that might be harbored by a jury in the jury pool, but that nonetheless such bias might exist and that it will afford a more fair and impartial jury if attorneys have the opportunity to use a peremptory challenge to remove those jurors. This court has also recognized, again, in cases like the Fever, Blades v. Defoe, that there are jurors who might not harbor a bias that rises to a causal challenge or the level of a Sixth Amendment challenge, but nonetheless harbor partiality towards one side or the other, and that if one side is afforded more challenges, a permanent challenge than the other, then the partiality of the jury could be tilted, and that could affect the outcome of the case.
Yeah, is that the basis of this court's decision in Fever? I mean, basically, I mean,
I believe so.
Justice Martinez went through this whole thing, and it was, that's 2000. I mean, what's changed since 2000?
Absolutely nothing, Your Honor. Nothing meaningful has changed. This court has clearly and repeatedly stated that its precedent in this matter is based on state law. What has happened in the federal system adds nothing to the analysis under stare decisis. Stare decisis asks what changing conditions would lead the court to an opposite outcome. But this court never based its analysis on state law, so why would the decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court compel an opposite conclusion by this court and compel it to jettison over 100 years of precedent?
But didn't we actually conclude in Lefebvre that the nature of the violation resulted in a 14th Amendment due process violation? And didn't Rivera then basically conclude, actually, that type of inequality doesn't actually result in a 14th Amendment due process violation? Is that not more recent precedent that it often taken into account, and we have not yet taken into account?
Well, Your Honor, this court did mention what you just mentioned regarding the 14th Amendment violation in Lefebvre. However, this court also clearly based its ruling on Lefebvre on Colorado law. You could beg my forgiveness, I'm going to read again another case. This is from Lefebvre. In that opinion, this court stated, our decisions have consistently recognized that under Colorado law, a defendant suffers a reversible prejudice if he is forced to use a peremptory challenge to remove a juror whom the trial court fails to remove for cause and he exhausts his peremptory challenges. That federal law governing the use of peremptory challenges differs from Colorado law governing the use of peremptory challenges does not alter the effect of Ross, the U.S. Supreme Court case, and applied to Colorado law. So again, it is true that this court did mention that 14th Amendment violation, but clearly the fever is based on Colorado law as well.
Could I ask you, why do you think he threw in that sentence about violating the 14th Amendment in Lefebvre? Wasn't the rationale there, didn't we say, well, it would violate the 14th Amendment if you're providing this right under state law, and that's violated? If that's true, then why didn't we just rest our holding on the fact that there was a violation of state law? That it had, was there something about the 14th Amendment that affected the remedy, or why were we doing that?
I don't know, Your Honor. Perhaps Perhaps this court probably just added extra force to what it was already stating regarding Colorado law, regarding the right that's created under Colorado law. But clearly, the Lefebvre opinion does not rest on the 14th Amendment or constitute the U.S. Constitution. There was some discussion on the Attorney General's argument. Also, the Attorney General suggested that parity is not important in peremptory challenges, that it's not important that each side is afforded.
Can I ask you a kind of fundamental question here?
Certainly.
I think Justice Rice asked and Justice Marcus asked your predecessors in argument. Basically, as I see what they're saying, okay, we have this new precedent from the United States Supreme Court. It's clearly not a constitutional right. And then at the same time, this is an unusual, you know, it's a state right, it's a substantive right, and we're not going to apply harmless error. Right? That's basically what the bottom line is, at least as I look at it. So, what's the reason for having this state right be substantial? What is it? What's behind it here? And why is it important or is it not? Tell us if you can. And that's another question that Justice Rice wanted to know. What's the jurisprudential difference between a state proceeding and a federal proceeding? Because clearly in the federal court you don't have that right.
Certainly, Your Honor. But in terms of the value, I think as this court has recognized many times.
Well, aside from precedent, we got the precedent arguments.
I'm glad we made
that. You made it, everybody's made it. We can read the cases. I think we may have different interpretations of them. But we understand the issue of precedent, and we understand the basis for allegedly overruling it and distinguishing cases. But what are we talking about?
As I think I alluded to earlier, there is tremendous importance with the peremptory challenge in the light of the fact that the peremptory challenge recognizes the reality of voir dire, that an attorney is not going to have an opportunity to establish on the record that a juror harbors some sort of bias will be leaning towards one side or the other. And the jury might not be able to do that because of a time crunch. The juror simply might be shy or inarticulate. Or the juror might express those kinds of thoughts, but then later, when the prosecution and the judge asks if they can follow the law, they might feel intimidated and reverse course. Now, I think the peremptory challenge recognizes that those jurors are out there and that the peremptory challenge is essential for eliminating those jurors from the jury pool. The peremptory challenge also recognizes that there are jurors who might not harbor the sort of bias that would rise to a challenge for cause or Sixth Amendment violation, but nonetheless are partial towards either side. And I think our peremptory challenge statute, 1610.104, recognizes that parity between the parties.
Well, why is this different than any other state right, non-constitutional state right?
Well, I think it's different. First off, I think it's significant that 1610.104 states that each party shall receive a certain number of challenges. I think that is a clear sign from the legislature, as this court has interpreted it as such over and over, that each side must receive those challenges, and that it's a severe error if one side cannot exercise a challenge or effectively waste a challenge in removing a biased juror. And I think, in a way, Colorado, in granted, this court recognized that Colorado is, well, not necessarily alone in treasuring, valuing the peremptory challenge more than other states.
Well, Kentucky apparently does.
That's true. There are other states that revere the peremptory challenge, like as this court has for over 100 years. Kentucky, Massachusetts and New York follow similar rules. Several other states, including Pennsylvania, Virginia, West Virginia, do still follow similar rules. But this court has recognized that Colorado is different than other states in how it reviews the peremptory challenge, and how the peremptory challenge, again, is essential to ensuring a fair and impartial jury, as a fair and impartial jury is conceived under Colorado law.
Thank you.
I would just leave it reminding this court of the doctrine of stare decisis, because it is the lens through which this issue must be analyzed. The doctrine provides that a court will follow the law as established in earlier cases unless clearly convinced that the rule is originally erroneous or no longer sound because of changing conditions, and that more good than harm will come from departing from precedent. And again, I would submit to you that the state has established nothing to show that generations of justices got it wrong when they affirmed the rule for us over and over in cases like McCrander and Fever, cases like Kennedy, and nothing meaningful has changed since McCrander.
Thank you, Mr. Arvin.
Thank you.
Ms. Brady, you have a bottle.
Oh, thank you. But the fact that Lefebvre, we did cite in the footnote 35P, which is basically a harmless error rule, that just reinforces my earlier argument that there's no consideration of substantial rights outside of the effect and outcome on the verdict, which is the harmless error rule. And Rivera v. Illinois is recent precedent that is a reason to overturn Lefebvre, and basically the development of harmless error jurisprudence is also a very good reason to depart from stare decisis.
But that's also, that's just affirming what the federal constitutional law is, right?
That's correct. But we usually do follow the United States Constitution.
And sometimes we've departed from it.
Sometimes
in the area of privacy we certainly have, right?
Correct.
And instances.
They think we're bound by
it. If there are no further questions, people would ask that this court reverse the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank both parties for your briefs and your arguments, and we'll